the way I'd like to begin is sort of tell you a bit, perhaps, about how I got into copyright and what sort of things there are for people to do, and what I'm doing now. So I'm dressed in my official Google gear here, and we sort of get these things for free when you join. I have on my Kermit the Frog shoes here. This something of a sneaker culture a bit in Google. The two things you notice about Google are that the food is really free everywhere, and people bring their dogs to work. There's amazing toilets too, these electronic toilets. The perks are pretty amazing, but you know it's a fun place to work, and we do some interesting things which we'll talk about. So I started out actually as a music major in college. I didn't do political science. I didn't do economics. I didn't do anything where I had to count above 64, and that was rare too. 32nd notes would be the most one would usually do. So, my math abilities are very, very slight. So I did music. I grew up in Northern California, Marin County, which is a great place to grow up, especially in the 60s. Robin Williams was in my sister's class. He was 2 years behind me, and we didn't associate, with people 2 years behind you. I wish I had. I would have been funnier had I done it. Although my sister's not funny, so maybe it wouldn't have worked out. She's just unusual. right? Lives up in the Sierra Nevadas. So grew up there. I was a music major. Went to conservatory and then went to a regular university to get a regular sort of degree. But I didn't want to go get a PhD. I got a BA and then a master's, actually a BM and an MM is what they were, and didn't want to go to get a PhD. I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself, which was not unusual for people in Marin County in the 60s. Other than hanging out, smoking dope, going surfing, stuff like that. That was fine, but it was hard to make a living, and my parents expected a bit more of me than that, so I didn't really want to disappoint them completely. So I had a girlfriend, and her parents lived in Houston, and she said, well, let's go down to Houston. I thought, who wants to go to Houston? And my parents said, don't do it. You're leaving paradise for hell. And not only because we actually lived on Paradise Drive, but I think it was a comparative statement about the two areas. And indeed, it was hell. they were right. They were right. I lived there for 5 years, and the first 3 years I got lost because I kept saying I was going to go home, and I wouldn't learn the freeway system, because if I learned the freeway system, it would be an admission that I was staying. So I eventually, after 3 years, I figured out I was staying for a while, and so I learned the freeway system. I got a job at the University of Houston as a research assistant in urban studies, which showed you that anybody could do anything in Houston in those days, because I grew up in Marin County in the suburbs, so I didn't know anything about cities. And Houston didn't have any zoning, and it still has no zoning, right? So the idea that you could actually do urban studies there was unusual. But as it turned out, my boss ran a joint urban studies JD program. And so he said, well, you could be the administrator of this, because I wasn't really doing much else. And then he said, if you want to go to law school, go ahead, you're not really doing very much anyway, even with your increased responsibilities. And it was only $90 a semester as a university employee. I hadn't really liked lawyers, but I thought, well, hell, for $90 a semester, I'm not going to make a career in urban studies, so I might as well do something. So, I went to law school. It was the only place I applied. Might have been the only place that would take me anyway, but it was $90, it was a great deal. So I went, and then I took a class of copyright. I thought, well, it's the only class that actually has something to do with what I did in college. And I was taught by an adjunct patent lawyer. If I've been going to school here and had Doton, I might have made something of my life. But indeed, I was going there. I was taught by an adjunct patent lawyer. So you have to sort of learn on your own. We had a great casebook. It was Nimmer's casebook at that time. It was the only one that had pictures, and it was really great. It was, to have a law school book that had pictures in those days was quite novel, and I loved the casebook. there was an exam, of course, as there always is, and I got the top grade in the class, but for strange reasons. I did the exam, it was one essay. You know, he wasn't going to, he was a private practitioner, he wasn't going to actually write a real exam. So he wrote, basically an essay about the Sony case. And so I did it from the standpoint of three different judges. So I discussed, three different ways to sort of come out in the case, and he thought that was novel, I guess. So I got the top grade in the class, which oddly enough made me think I actually knew something about copyright and maybe could do it. So there was a contest, I think there still is, the ASCAP sponsors, this Nathan Burton contest to have law students get interested in copyright law. And there was a cash award. And I thought, well, no, then there are these other people who are going to be interested in copyright. They won't enter this contest and I'll win and I'll get the money. And, it was true. I was the only one who entered and I won the money. So, I thought, okay, I won this contest, although it's easy to win if you're the only one. Again, I might know something. So I did an article about copyright and community property, because California is a community property state, Texas is a community property state, and the issue was how are, if they are, community property laws preempted, right? Could a state say that a non-author spouse is actually an author, as compared to saying, if you get divorced, the non-author spouse gets half of the estate, and that half may include an interest, in a copyright, or an interest in royalties. That was sort of the idea. So I sent it in over the transom, as they used to say during the Anita Hill hearings, to the Journal of the Copyright Society, and they published the thing. And, I was stunned. Again, so I decided I'd write another article, and they published that one. And then I wrote a third article, because I arrived pretty quickly. And finally, the guy who was the editor of it, who was Alan Lattman, he taught at NYU and founded a really great boutique firm in New York called Connelly, Woods & Lattman, said, look, I got to stop publishing your articles because people are beginning to wonder about us. I think maybe you're paying me to publish your stuff. So I got to stop publishing them, but I will get you a job in the field. Right? So he called up a friend of his who had been the general counsel of the Copyright Office and had left in 1979 and had a branch office of a New York firm in Washington, D.C. And so he got me a job with him. And that's how I ended up in copyright law in Washington, D.C. We had a Washington practice. So by that I mean this. We represent trade associations. We represent the Association of American Publishers, Motion Picture Association, National Music Publishers. We did sort of test litigation for them, the Texaco case, which you may get to, on photocopying and fair use was one of those. But we also did lobbying for them on Capitol Hill with the Copyright Office and with the Judiciary Committees who have jurisdiction over copyright. And because the guy who gave him the job, John Baumgarten, had been general counsel. The Judiciary Committee knew him, and they knew him as a substantive expert. Right? One thing you find on Capitol Hill, and I worked there for 7 years, is the idea of lobbyists being a negative thing isn't really quite true. You as a staff person or as a member of Congress will take information from whoever you can get it from, so long as it's good information. Right? You don't care if they're a lawyer, you don't care if they're not a lawyer, you don't care if they're a lobbyist, or you don't care who they are. Right? If you're interested in the subject that you're thinking about legislating on, if someone can give you good substantive knowledge that's fair and accurate, you'll take it from them. Right? And if someone does that regularly, then you rely on them. Right? If they do it and they're not honest about it or they're incomplete, then you don't rely on them. Right? So John had a good reputation because he had been a general counsel. So I started doing a fair amount of legislative stuff, and that's what I mean by a New York Washington practice. You do, some litigation, and you do a fair amount of legislative stuff, and it's, it's something that's sort of unique to the city there. And so I got a lot of experience with the Copyright Office that way. They decided to close down that office because they said it wasn't profitable. Copyright is the least profitable of the three fields of intellectual property. We sort of compensate by saying it's the most interesting, and maybe it's the only one that's intellectual property. The others are industrial property or something else. For patent lawyers, the joke is that they're the only group that have failed the two professions. So they make more money, but they're just not as interesting intellectually. So I then got an offer from the Register of Copyrights to go work for him. This was when the United States was thinking of joining the Berne Convention, 1987. So I worked there from 87 to 92, I think. And that was a great job. We did policy stuff. You know, we drafted legislation. We testified. I went on delegations with the State Department to negotiate copyright around the world. We had the world divided up. I had the areas of the world where the men wore skirts or dresses, which means I had the Middle East and Scotland, although I think that was sort of a cruel joke because I never really got to go to Scotland. You know, I did have to go to the Middle East. I went to Saudi Arabia and a number of other places. Then, let's see, in 1992, Mr. Kastenmeier, who had been the chair of the subcommittee for almost 30 years, was defeated in his election by a TV anchor fellow called Scott Kluge in Wisconsin. So a new chairman took over, and his chief counsel called me up and asked if he could come over and talk to me. The answer is always yes, by the way. If a member of Congress or their staff asks if they can talk to you and you work for an agency that is under them, you always say yes. So I said yes. And he came over and said, well, why don't you come work directly for the subcommittee? So I did that. And that was great. I did that for 3 years until the 1994 elections, and you know, the House flipped to being Republican. And so I stayed there till January 95. And then a friend of mine who taught at Cardozo said, well, why don't you come teach at Cardozo? So, and there's sort of a history here of me never planning anything out and people saying, why don't you come do this? And I just say, yes. You know, I've been fortunate that the things people have asked me to do are good things. If they had not been good things, I probably still would have said yes, you know, because I know what else to do with myself. So I did that for 5 years, and you know, it was great being a full-time faculty member. It was certainly a big change from Washington, which was good. But then, as Dota mentioned, we had twins, and sending them to a private religious school, you know, you can't do that in New York City on the money that they had. So I went out back into private practice. This was at Skadden Arps, which was a small firm at that time. How many do we have? New York office, and we had over 1,000 lawyers, I think, in the New York office. And that was, you know, it was good. It was a great firm. But I decided eventually I wanted to go in-house. I didn't like the idea of chasing business and billable hours and everything else. And so I ended up at Google because they have a lot of interesting copyright issues, and I didn't have to wear a suit either and fit more my sort of personality. I joined them a little bit before the YouTube deal. And so my title, which means nothing, is Senior Copyright Counsel. It means nothing because there's no Junior Copyright Counsel. Right? It's a bit like Upper and Lower Volta, right? There's no Lower Volta, there's just an Upper Volta. So I'm senior by myself. We have, actually, I work in the New York office. We have 4 lawyers in New York, about 525 other people there, split between ad people and engineers. And 4 lawyers. I think they have maybe 150 in the company altogether, many of them in Mountain View where the headquarters are, but some in Washington, D.C. We have 5 policy lawyers in Washington, D.C. who do traditional lobbying. We have government relations, it's called, I think, in the pretty word. And there's also policy people, global policy people, you know, who do stuff with the European Union or with Australia. There's actually a lot of legislative initiatives in common law countries right now. Australia's been going through something, New Zealand, there was a Gowers report in England, Canada. So a number of these countries are looking at their copyright laws, maybe to see if they can do to theirs what we did to ours in the DMCA, or maybe do better, which Dotan said he's going to threaten you with near the end of the semester, the last third of it. That wasn't on my watch. That was in 1998. I left in 1995, so you can't blame me for that. Although you can blame me, of course, for the bootleg statute, which I think Dotan passed out the Fordham transcript from. And you know, that was an interesting experience. We're still waiting for the opinion. That was argued in November of 2005. This is a really long time for a court of appeals opinion. I had one that was almost as long, but what happened there was, this was called Register.com versus Ferial. It wasn't even a copyright case, it was a trademark case. And it was before a panel of Judge LaValle, Judge Parker from Vermont, and a district judge. And the panel, I felt great after the argument. And so good, in fact, that the lawyer on the other side came up and said, congratulations. So, you know, you feel pretty good about that. Then we waited and waited and waited and waited. And then Judge Parker died. So I thought, wow, okay. He didn't die because of the argument, I hope. But actually died because he wouldn't go to the doctors and have his heart checked. At least that's what Judge LaValle says. So and we waited, waited, and waited, waited some more. So as it turns out, what happened was Judge LaValle was the presiding judge, and he assigned the case to Judge Parker. And Judge Parker was unanimous, affirming the preliminary injunction from my side, right? So he signed to Judge Parker. Judge Parker starts to write on it. He hires another clerk who is, as we described him then, an infocommie. And this clerk writes like this 50-page opinion coming out the other way, which he gives to Judge Parker, and Judge Parker accepts it. Right, so he goes to Judge LaValle and says, "Wow, yeah, I've got the opinion for you, but I'm rather sorry to say that I've come out the other way." And Judge LaValle said, "Well, that's nice, but we haven't, right? So go back and try again." And then he died. Right, so Judge LaValle then had to write the opinion himself. And one thing is the presiding judge in these cases, if you're not writing the opinion, the level of detail I think that you pay to the argument is somewhat less, and a year and a half later, after having paid even less attention because you, farmed the job out to somebody else, you have to sort of start from scratch. So he actually did that, and he wrote a rather brief opinion, not surprisingly. And then he did something that was sort of strange, which is he appended Judge Parker's unpublished, opinion, which said basically, hey, he was working on this when he died, and he did a lot of work on it. Right, his clerk did a lot of work on it. And so we're including it here for people to see. And if you read it, you think, thank God, this didn't become a majority. It's insane. It's like, to think that that he was one vote away from something like that actually becoming the opinion, it was scary. But thank God Judge Keenan, didn't flip too. I worked on those sort of things. And now Google, I do product things. We have the Google Book Search, which some of you may be interested in. And my treatise is going to be in Google Book Search now, which I think is good, at least for people who want it on. I don't quite get it. I don't think, the way it works, of course, is there's two tiers to Google Book Search. There's the authorized one, which is the publishers agree that you can put this on Google Book Search and you can search the entire book, but what comes up is somewhat limited. You get the page it's on, you get a few sentences here or there, you can do a number of searches, but not ad infinitum. So if you want to find out whether a book is useful, it's a good tool. I think I probably bought 60 books myself last year using Google Book Search. So I don't believe that it harms the market, I think it helps the market for it. So to be consistent, I had to put my own on, which I did, it's going to be on. But, a one-volume book, I think, is rather different than a seven-volume reference book in law. So I don't really get why people think it should be on, but I took so much flack from people who said, well, you work for Google. If you really believe, in the project, you'd put your own book on, right? So I did. Or we're going to. And so people will use it or not, or find it useful or not, but at least saves me having to face, charges of being hypocritical. So we do product stuff. We do, for example, on the Google map, which even the president uses the Google, and he uses it for that. Or I don't know what he's looking for. He's trying to find where some countries are. You can do great things with that. So you can integrate, the Google Book Search to that. So if, let's say, you're going to a particular city, and you want to find out something about, this block or this house, or whether somebody said something about that, Now, using integrating that with Google Book Search, you could find, wherever you're going, any book that happens to be in our system, which, you know, grandiosely we hope will be all the books in the world, what they've said about it. Right? So you find, like, some landmark, you know, who slept here, or who wrote a book here, or who lived here, or who said something about this area. Right? So we're integrating the map search to the book search. So that's sort of a cool thing to work on. Obviously, there's issues with YouTube, and those will, you know, continue. I don't know how that will work out in terms of cutting deals and things, but, you know, as a business, you know, Google is in the business of business, not in the business of litigation, and few companies actually are. I did go to the Microsoft AT&T argument yesterday on patents, so I can talk about that. So that's sort of a longer introduction than I wanted. So now you have to do your bit since I did mine. And I'll answer any questions that you have about anything I've done or things I should have done or done better.